stretched at ease upon a sofa, in gown and slippers, Harker Brayton smiled at something he had just read. And as a train of reflection followed, for Brayton was a man of thought, he unconsciously lowered his book without altering the direction of his eyes. As soon as the volume had gone below the line of sight, something in an obscure corner of the room recalled his attention to his surroundings. What he saw, in the shadow under his bed, were two small points of light, apparently about an inch apart. They might have been reflections of the gas jet above him, in metal nail heads. He gave them but little thought, and resumed his reading. A moment later, some impulse, which it did not occur to him to analyze, impelled him to lower the book again, and seek for what he saw before. The points of light were still there. They seemed to have become brighter than before, shining with a greenish luster, which he had not at first observed. He thought, too, that they might have moved a trifle, were somewhat nearer. Brayton, half-risen, stared intently into the obscurity beneath the bed, where the points of light shone with, it seemed to him, an added fire. His attention was now fully aroused, his gaze eager and imperative. It disclosed, almost directly beneath the footrail of the bed, the coils of a large serpent. The points of light were its eyes. Its horrible head thrust flatly forth from the innermost coil, and resting upon the outermost, was directed straight toward him. The eyes were no longer merely luminous points. They looked into his own with a meaning, a malign significance. A snake in a bedroom of a modern urban dwelling of the better sort is, happily, not so common a phenomenon as to make explanation altogether needless. Harker Brayton, a bachelor of 35, a scholar, idler, and something of an athlete, rich, popular, and of sound health, had returned to the city of his birth from all manner of remote and unfamiliar countries, and had gladly accepted the hospitality of his friend, Dr. Droring, the distinguished scientist. Dr. Droring's house, a large, old-fashioned one, was a combination of laboratory, menagerie, and museum. It was here, in a separate wing of the mansion, that the doctor indulged the professional side of his nature in the study of such forms of animal life as engaged his interest and comforted his taste, which, it must be confessed, ran rather to the lower forms. His scientific sympathies were distinctly reptilian. He loved nature's vulgarians and described himself as the Zola of zoology. Despite the snakery, as it was known, and its uncanny associations, to which indeed he gave little attention, Harker Brayton found life at the Droring Mansion very much to his mind. And so, beyond a smart shock of surprise and a shudder of mere loathing, Mr. Brayton was not greatly affected by his discovery. His first thought was to ring the call bell and bring a servant. But although the bell cord dangled within easy reach, he made no movement toward it. It had occurred to his mind that the act might subject him to the suspicion of fear, which he certainly did not feel. He was more keenly conscious of the incongruous nature of the situation than affected by its perils. It was revolting, but absurd. The reptile was of a species with which Brayton was unfamiliar. Its length he could only conjecture. The body, at the largest visible part, seemed about as thick as his forearm. In what way was it dangerous, if in any way? Was it venomous? Was it a constrictor? If not dangerous, the creature was at least offensive. It was de trop. Matter out of place. An impertinence. Besides, insupportable thought, the exhalations of its breath mingled with the atmosphere which he himself was breathing. These thoughts shaped themselves with greater or less definition in Brayton's mind and begot action. So he rose to his feet and prepared to back softly away from the snake, without disturbing it, if possible, and through the door. Should the monster follow, the taste which had plastered the walls with paintings had consistently supplied a rack of murderous oriental weapons from which he could snatch one to suit the occasion. In the meantime, the snake's eyes burned with a more pitiless malevolence than ever. Brayton lifted his right foot free of the floor to step backward. That moment he felt a strong aversion to doing so. "I'm accounted brave," he muttered. "Is bravery, then, no more than pride? Because there are none to witness the shame, shall I retreat?" He lifted the foot a little higher by slightly bending the knee and thrust it sharply to the floor, an inch in front of the other. He could not think how that occurred. A trial with the left foot had the same result. It was again in advance of the right. The hand upon the chair back was grasping it. The arm was straight, reaching somewhat backward. One might have seen that he was reluctant to lose his hold. The snake's malignant head was still thrust forth from the inner coil as before, the neck level. It had not moved, but its eyes were now electric sparks, radiating an infinity of luminous needles. The man had an ashy pallor. Again he took a step forward, and another, partly dragging the chair, which, when finally released, fell upon the floor with a crash. The man groaned. The snake made neither sound nor motion, but its eyes were two dazzling suns. The reptile itself was wholly concealed by them. They gave off enlarging rings of rich and vivid colours, which at their greatest expansion successively vanished like soap bubbles. They seemed to approach his very face, and anon were an immeasurable distance away. He heard somewhere the continuous throbbing of a great drum, with desultory bursts of far music inconceivably sweet, like the tones of an Aeolian harp, and thought he stood in the Nileside reeds, hearing with exalted sense that immortal anthem through the silence of the centuries. The music ceased. Rather, it became, by insensible degrees, the distant roll of a retreating thunderstorm. A landscape, glittering with sun and rain, stretched before him, arched with a vivid rainbow, framing in its giant curve 100 visible cities. In the middle distance, a vast serpent, wearing a crown, reared its head out of its voluminous convolutions and looked at him with his dead mother's eyes. Suddenly, this dreamlike landscape seemed to rise swiftly upward, like the drop scene at a theatre, and vanished in a blank. Something struck him a hard blow upon the face and breast. For a moment he was dazed and stunned, and lay with closed eyes, his face against the floor. In a few moments he had recovered, and then realized that his fall, by withdrawing his eyes, had broken the spell which held him. He felt that now, by keeping his gaze averted, he would be able to retreat. But the thought of the serpent within a few feet of his head, yet unseen, perhaps in the very act of springing upon him and throwing its coils about his throat, was too horrible. He lifted his head, stared again into those baleful eyes, and was again in bondage. The snake had not moved, but beneath that flat and brainless brow, its black, beady eyes simply glittered, as at first, with an expression unspeakably malignant. It was as if the creature, knowing its triumph assured, had determined to practice no more alluring wiles. Now ensued a fearful scene. The man, prone upon the floor, within a yard of his enemy, raised the upper part of his body upon his elbows, his head thrown back, his legs extended their full length. Strong convulsions ran through him, making almost serpentine undulations. He bent himself at the waist, shifting his legs from side to side. Yet every movement left him a little nearer to the snake. He thrust his hands forward to brace himself back, yet he constantly advanced upon his elbows. Dr. Droring and his wife sat in the library. The scientist was in rare good humour. "I have just obtained," he said, "a splendid specimen of the Ophiophagus." "And what may that be?" the lady inquired with a somewhat languid interest. He sighed. Any man who ascertains after marriage that his wife does not know Greek is entitled to a divorce. The Ophiophagus is a snake which eats other snakes. I hope it will eat all yours, she said, absently shifting the lamp. But how does it get the other snakes? By charming them, I suppose. That is just like you, dear, said the doctor, with an affectation of petulance. You know how irritating to me is any allusion to that vulgar superstition about the snake's power of fascination. The conversation was interrupted by a mighty cry, which rang through the silent house like the voice of a demon shouting in a tomb. Again and yet again it sounded, with terrible distinctness. They sprang to their feet, the man confused, the lady pale and speechless with fright. Almost before the echoes of the last cry had died away, the doctor was out of the room, springing up the staircase two steps at a time. In the corridor, in front of Brayton's chamber, he met some servants who had come from the upper floor. Together, they rushed at the door without knocking. It was unfastened and gave way. Brayton lay upon his stomach on the floor, dead. His head and arms were partly concealed under the footrail of the bed. They pulled the body away, turning it upon the back. The face was daubed with blood. The eyes were wide open, staring. A dreadful sight. Died in a fit, said the scientist, bending his knee and placing his hand upon the heart. While in that position, he happened to glance under the bed. Good God, he added. How did this thing get in here? He reached under the bed, pulled out the snake, and flung it, still coiled, to the center of the room, whence with a harsh, shuffling sound it slid across the polished floor till stopped by the wall, where it lay without motion. It was a stuffed snake. Its eyes, two shoe buttons.
Robert Lang was reading The Man and the Snake by Ambrose Bierce. It was produced by Maurice Leach.